Alright, so we start with some motivations. Alright, so, well, I guess the main point is that N equals 4 sigma unknown is actually the only field theory in which we could really, in four dimensions, which we could actually ask this question, because the ADS-CFT correspondence gives us access to both the strong and the weak coupling regimes. And so we can ask questions about what the full phase structure is at all couplings and at all temperatures. So that's sort of the field theory motivation, how we can get into the strong coupling regime. Now, from the gravity point of view, another motivation is that, well, people ask things like, what happened to the black hole singularity and weak coupling? And so we'd like to follow the gravity down all the way to weak coupling. Of course, we want to do that. We want to know what the phase, I mean, there's a phase condition on the way to weak coupling that's going to change the way we think about these questions. So an important theme taken from both of these in this talk is going to be how similar is thermal. So most of this talk is all going to be about thermal supernovae theory. How similar are the strong and weak coupling regimes? So that's relevant to the black hole singularity. But let's take another context in which this might be relevant. So suppose we wanted to understand black hole evaporation. Okay, which is an interesting and difficult question, and maybe the ADS-CFT correspondence can help us. So we have a problem. So if we really want to study evaporation of a black hole, what's really interesting, I think, is the end point, where it's not just semi-classical Hawking radiation. So what happens if the temperatures get large around the black hole? And of course, well, let's try to set this up in ADS-CFT. So we get some diagram like this one. And this is really no good, because what we're interested in is the strong coupling region here. But the point is there's a weak coupling region, a weakly curved region outside it. And that means the appropriate dual description for this system is a strongly coupled field theory, which of course we then say we don't know much about. But we might ask then, okay, well, suppose we can't ask this question. Let's just make the curvatures large everywhere, so that the curvatures are large even isotopically. So that means go to weak coupling in field theory. And let's ask the same question. Can we study black hole evaporation, for example, and weak coupling in field theory? So this is the kind of logic we'd like to do, but of course we can only do this and hope to get some qualitative insights if the phase structure, weak coupling of thermal M-mills is similar to the phase structure at strong coupling. Okay. So I'm not going to talk about black hole evaporation in this talk, that's just an illustration of how you might end up thinking about these questions. So why, what's known? So there's been a lot of progress recently in this question. By Acheroni and Nuala, a bunch of other people. And this is basically what's known at the moment. So what's been known for a long time is that a strong coupling, so in a gravity regime, so this is basically temperature going up this axis and lambda going on this axis. Now this is the full phase diagram on S3 plus R. For most of this talk, I'm actually going to be talking about field theory on R3. So that would be the very sort of high up region as we go across there. Okay, but this is the full picture. Okay, so we've got this Hawking phase transition that's known, and what Acheroni and collaborators showed is that a weak coupling, there are two possibilities. Well, okay, at zero coupling, it's the same. You have a Hagedorn first order transition. And this is optimistic for the kind of scenario I'm presenting, which seems that the physics is similar to the strong coupling physics of finite temperature. You have this, i.e., you have this phase transition as a function of temperature. And then if you go to slightly non-zero coupling, they show there are two possibilities. Either there's a first order transition that continues, or it splits into two, and you have a second order Hagedorn transition, and a third order gross Witten transition. I'll talk a little bit more about what these transitions are later, maybe. Okay, but now what I'm interested in this talk is what happens in this direction on this axis. So, what this back group did was conjecture sort of minimal interpolation. Really good at the previous stuff, transparency. And so in the first case, well, you've got two first order transitions, so it's really very tempting to just draw a line between them. And in the second case, well, the minimal thing, you've got to have at least one critical point, because this second order thing is going to turn into the first order transition. And so the minimal thing you can do is take this third order thing and make it join in the same kind of tri-critical point. But I don't think there's any evidence for this apart from that. Okay? So that's what's known. And if this is true, this is great. So if either of these pictures are true, I think it does make sense to study, say, black hole evaporation, black hole singularities at weak coupling, and try to get some qualitative insight like that. So, right, so let's see, in this talk, it's going to be about getting at this, trying to find some evidence whether this, that thing is true or not, or whether there might be something more complicated. You might have more facial issues in the plot. Okay, so that's the motivation and what's known. So let me just give you the structure of what I'm going to talk about. So this is going to be kind of in quite indirect approach to this question, but we'll make contact with it in the end. And what I'm going to look at is this propagator, so tracer squared, at finite temperature on R13. Now, one thing that we're going to do, I think is interesting, is that we're going to be looking at real-time propagators. So this is not just the equilibrium theory, we're looking at responses away from equilibrium. And of course, a lot of progress has been made in that direction, also by Andrew Stonex and so on, and a lot of other people. And so we're going to make some contact with that work as well. And, right, and so what we're going to do, well, I'm going to compute this guy in two regimes. So the first half of the talk, I'm going to do the gravitational computation, well, or review it, because it's already been done, mostly, of this operator, this correlator. And then I'm going to map the gravitational results to field theory and say what this guy looks like in strong coupling. And I'm also going to talk about how to find corrections to the strong coupling results. Okay, so after that little talk, and I don't know about the field theory, but this talk will then undergo a phase transition, and I'm going to switch to a different language of surface field theory and thermal surface field theory in atom physics, and we're going to look at this correlator again in the weak coupling regime. And that's going to split into two bits of free theory, and then there's a discussion of quantum corrections to that. And okay, the punchline is going to be that these results are going to be quite different. And they're going to be different in a very well-defined and interesting way. And one possible implication of this is that the phase structure is not as simple as what I indicated before. Good. Okay, so let's start with gravity. So now we're looking at this correlator in the strong coupling regime. Okay, so we need a gravitational calculation. And to warm myself up to doing this, I want to just give a review of perturbations about black holes. This is a very, very old subject. I mean, it used to be part of astrophysics, when theoretical physics and real physics were still the same thing. But there's a very nice review in 95 by Ching and these other people. And that's the logic of what I'm going to follow now. So what do you want to do? So the idea is you take some space-time, you perturb it, and you want to see how the perturbations decay as a function of time. So you perturb your Einstein's equations, you linearize them into perturbations, you separate out the angular variables, and you're left with one equation for the radial dependence of your perturbation. And you can build a second-order equation, you can always put it into a Schrödinger form. So a generic perturbation of Einstein's equations gives you this Schrödinger equation, where V is some potential that comes depends on the space-time of the perturbation. Okay? And it's the frequency of the perturbation, and the potential will depend on the angular momentum. And to get here, you have to do a change of coordinates, very well known by now, which really do that change of coordinates. So R star is some radial coordinate for black hole space-time. So what did people do? So people wrote down this equation a very long time ago, and the first thing you can do is just, you know, put it on a computer, and it's a very simple equation, so even in those days, they put it on computers. And this is more or less what you get. And the main point that I want to make is there are three phases. There's a prompt contribution. This basically depends on what the actual perturbation is. It's not universal. Then there's this typical ring, quasi-normal modes at a certain specific frequency that depends on the space-time, and an exponential decay. And then at very late times, let's say we're doing a Schrödinger black. So this is the Schrödinger four-dimensional normal black hole, black space. Then you get this late time tail, which has a very characteristic rule, just T cubed plus 2L, L taking momentum. All right, so we've got this. This is sort of empirical. Should be relevant to gravitational waves, whatnot. And so now, let's see if we can understand that result. So the next step you do is you think about physics heuristically and see if we can understand its behavior. So, what is the potential? I haven't given you the formula, but roughly to say I'm doing Schwarzschild, four-dimensional Schwarzschild as Schwarzschild wrote it down. And this is the potential property that you get. And note that this R star for node goes from minus infinity to infinity, and Y infinity is asymptotic, so a long way away, and the other one is the eventual horizon. And there are two regimes. Near the horizon, the potential falls off exponentially, and at infinity, it falls off, well, that first term, which is a centrifugal barrier type term, and then there's an R, 1 over R star cubed, that falls off at infinity. So now let's think, let's draw a space-time diagram about the perturbation for this black hole. As you know, black hole. So here's our perturbation. Okay, and so this is space and this is time. So light rays travel at 45 degrees. Okay. So this is our perturbation is here, and we're sitting some distance away. We want to see what happens. So we wait, and the first thing that happens is we get a direct signal from the perturbation. Okay, this is just a prompt response, but nothing interesting. But what can also happen is this signal is traveling with potential and can get reflected multiple times. So another thing that can happen is the light ray can get bounced back and forth, the signal gets bounced back and forth various times before it reaches my radius. Yeah, okay. Let's see what happens with it scattering. So each scattering is going to dampen. Each scattering, you know, you get some absorption and some reflection. So the amount of reflected waves. I want to throw these in my hands, actually.
Oh, thanks.
Old fashioned. What can I say? So what you're interested in is the reflected amplitude. So the amount of reflected wave gets reduced every time you have a scattering process, okay? So the amount of reflected wave is going to fall down with scattering, internal scattering in the geometry, and that's going to be proportional. The more time you leave it for, the more time it's going to get reflected, and so the thing goes down exponentially, okay? And this is actually the quasi-normal contribution. And it turns out that in the geometry there are certain frequencies that minimize the amount of absorption that happens, and those are the quasi-normal frequencies you see at late time. So there's a period of exponential decay. Now what else could the signal do? So the signal could go a long, long way away, way beyond where I'm looking, and have one reflection, and then come back again at a very, very late time. Okay, and this is the late time tail. And so let's heuristically see what we expect that to be. Well, what's the amplitude of the scattering? Well, it's roughly going to be the potential at this far away point. It's traveling at the speed of light, so I just divide the potential at that time. And then I did a little trick, which is that I say, well, this is the potential at long distances, but actually it turns out if you do it properly, the first term, which is the centrifugal barrier, which is just flat space, doesn't contribute to this process, okay? Because that would be the region in flat space and there would be no scattering in flat space. So if we ignore that first term, the potential indeed has a 1 over R cubed, and so we get a 1 over T cubed decay. And for the L equals 0 mode, for 0 angular momentum, that's indeed what we saw in the numerical simulation case. So this is a very heuristic argument for why there's a 1 over T cubed decay at late times in the black hole space. Now, remember, it was actually 1 over T cubed plus 2L, and I don't know if it's a argument for that. Okay, so there's some enhancement when you have angular momentum in the system. But this is basically the physically the way you want to think about it, that these things are scattered out a long way away and then come back once. At a very late time, that's all that I'm seeing. Okay, so this is the heuristic argument. Now, if I wanted to make it precise, what would I do? Well, I would try to calculate the frequency space propagator. I mean, so this is just Fourier transform, but let me just go through it because it's setting up the kind of ideas I want to place it. So it's supposed to calculate the frequency transform Green's function. Then to get the time dependence, you just Fourier transform it. And so what do you do? Well, so this is the plot of frequency plane Green's function. And so what you want to do, obviously, you just want to integrate along there to take the Fourier transform, and you want the closed quantum. And then, well, the integral is going to be given by various non-nullities in the frequency space Green's function. And so what can happen? Well, you can have poles, or you can have branch cuts, right? And also, another thing that can happen is that when you close the contour of this bit that goes to infinity, it also gives you a finite answer. And those are those three times I've said without before. So the prompt contribution comes from any contribution that might exist in the Green's function when you close the contour. as you expect, that large omega, small t, that gives you the sort of immediate contribution. Then you've got these poles, which have are away from that axis, so that they're going to give you an exponential decay, because it's going to be e to the I omega t, especially with these guys. So and in fact, the lowest pole is going to give you the dominant oscillations at late time, because it decays minimally. And then there's this branch cut, and this branch cut uses the late time tail. Okay. So this is sort of the best way to think about it. Although, of course, it's not so easy to calculate the Green's function. Right, so that's the story for the Schwarzschild and Pratt space. Now, because we're interested in duality, I want to go to the ADS case. Now, it's been known for a long time. Now, there's some work by Boris and Domeni, but also it's in this paper implicit in this paper by Ching, I mentioned. That an ADS potential is very different. In particular, so, okay, I'm inverting the R star now, so now this is now the horizon. Okay, I just didn't want it to go to minus infinity to zero, so it's going from zero to infinity. And the asymptotic is at zero. So it's well known that gravity in ADS is like gravity in a box. Okay, it kind of wants to pull things in. And so the potential goes up. And there's only one asymptotic region which has an exponential decay. Okay? Now remember that the power law decay in Schwarzschild was related to a power law pull-off of the potential at large distances. Here we have an exponential pull-off at large distances. So we don't expect a power law tail in the ADS black hole. And in fact, that's more or less what was found. So, and what Boris and Domeni found these various quasi-normal frequencies using ADS in the way that I'll talk about. So they just numerically found these frequencies. So this is the plot for ADS Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, you have a frequency space for the Green's function, and a series of poles, and there's no branch cuts, and in particular no parallel tail. And this is particular. I mean, this is not a generic flat space spacetime. It is very particular to ADS. That you have this exponential decay and you have the box there. Okay. Right. So in fact, what I want to do is the next slide is going to be a bit technical, and what I want to show is that you can actually prove, not the heuristics, that when there's an exponential pull off in the potential, that there are no cuts go from away to omega equals zero. Okay? So that as there was in the Schwarzschild case. Alright. So this is a form of proof that I think is used quite a lot by mathematicians in ODEs and also by physicists in pre-1950 when they were still studying Schrödinger equation. So what's it is? We have a Schrödinger equation and some V. And what I want to study here is going to be the solution phi as a function of omega. Okay, not as a function of x, but as a function of the frequency. Okay, so suppose I fix my point in space, and I want to see how the solution at that point depends on the frequency, okay, whether they're non-elasticities. So what do we do? So we start with the Schrödinger equation, and we rewrite it as an integral equation. Okay, so this equation there is the same one as that. We differentiate it a couple of times. And so you have to include one extra ingredient, which is the boundary condition, because we've integrated up. Okay, and so that's that e I omega r star there. And that's the boundary, that's the so-called ingoing boundary conditions at the horizon. So you don't want any stuff coming out of the horizon. Okay? That's what that's. So one way of solving integral equations is a series, a so-called Born. I mean, the name indicates how old this kind of logic is. So you make a Born series, so you say, I write some series, and then I solve them recursively. So I set a zero mode to be e to the omega r star. And then you can see that what I put in there is going to come back. So when you plug this series into here, the n minus 1 mode is then come down to the nth. So the nth one depends on the nth minus 1 on the other side. Okay, that's the recurrentialization. Now the point about this recurrentialization is you can, what I want to show, the next step is I want to show this power series expansion, not power series, sorry, this series expansion has certain convergent properties. Okay, in particular, I want to show that it's analytic in omega in some regime. Okay? So, well, let's first do continuity. So to show that this thing is continuous, I have to show that it converges absolutely. So I write down this, And then you use one of these arguments, and it's very similar to these arguments you use when you're doing these time-ordered propagators, when you're deriving in quantum field theory, when you're deriving e to the minus the action for the amplitude. Okay, you take all these, you have all these things, and then you sort of symmetrize them, you get 1 over n, and they end up being an exponent. Okay, so what I'm saying is this recurrence relation, for the nth series, you use it n times, and you get it down to psi of 0. Okay, and then so psi of n has sort of got n integrals in it. You sort of symmetrize the integral, and it ends up being an exponent, or you can bound it by an exponent. So the upshot is that this guy, I mean, that's the steps, but it is pretty basic. So this, the mod of the series turned out to be bounded by this exponential, some integral of b. Okay, there's a b. There's a b here. Okay, so that, and that's now in the exponential bounding the series by this process that I was talking about. Okay, and so in particular, if this is now finite, then this series converges. Okay, absolutely. And so what we need is this, in fact, I believe this integral to be finite. And so this is the potential times some exponential that's in fact, let me see if I remember growing, yes. Okay. So what we need is we need V to fall off exponentially because it's finite, which it does, but it is black hole. So if you plug in that exponential fall off, it is black hole, you get that there's a band of omega. So when we magnify the omega's weight from minus 2 pi, this integral turns out to be finite and the series converges absolutely, which means that this thing is continuous. So what's it found? So here's the omega plane. So what I've shown is that above this point, this is not a green function here, by the way, this is a general solution to the equation. So a solution to the equation depends analytically on omega in this upper half above here. And now to get analyticity, I need to actually differentiate this guy with respect to omega, and then show the differentiator series converges absolutely. When you can do that, and it's basically the same, it is the same power. So, what I've shown is that the ADF black hole, and this is, I haven't shown this, this is in this paper, basically adapted to this case. You have a region in which solutions are analytic in omega, in the 50s of plane. Is that, any questions?
So is it different from this argument of one? I remember that in the old papers, one argued that there is a difference between asymmetrical threat and asymmetrical radius, j's in the absence of this law. I mean, is it different from?
No, it sounds like it's the same. The fact of potential for a different form. Translating the fact that there's not a bunch of very
yes.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it's the same. I don't know what.
Okay.
Okay. Now you can then use this fact that the solutions as a function of omega in the any analysis, you can relate that to the Green's function. Okay, because there's a formula that's two solutions divided by the one scale. But let me get back to that in a second. Okay, so let's just remember for a moment that the solution depends analytically on omega in this region. There are no branch cuts and no poles, but I'll get the poles. All right. So now I want to map this ADF picture to field theory, a strong coupling. So we're doing Lorentzian ADS to T at finite temperature. There are some issues with boundary conditions at the horizon, unlike in Euclidean ADS, where it's fixed to you by regularity. And I don't want to go into this story, but it's, I think, been more or less resolved by the Sons science, Monte Castro, and various people. And this is the description, okay? So I'm just going to remind you of what the story is. So this is now, so G of omega is now the retarded Green function of the dual theory, okay, for the operator, dual to the perturbation. Okay, so I should say, trace F squared is dual to the dilaton. So I'm considering dilaton perturbations in the ball, which are getting mapped to the Green's function of trace F squared in the boundary. Okay. Alright, and so, well, what do we have? So basically, this is a normal, it's very similar to the usual ADS-CFT idea, right? So you're going to take your solution on the ball and sort of evaluate. Okay, the normal thing you do is you evaluate the action, right? And then at large R, and you differentiate various parameters to get the correlates. Okay, this is more or less where this comes from. And so what I need to do is we need to find a general solution, phi omega in the bulk, differentiated, do this distribution as sort of a normalization. And that's the answer. Okay. I need to solve the equation in the bulk, and that will give me the Green function on the boundary. And then I need to take the boundary to infinity and find the various divergences, which I need to normalize using holographic normalization as a normal intersect. Right, so the only point here is that there's a map, okay, from solutions on the bulk to a tidy Green function on the boundary. And what's the metric? So remember, I'm doing n equals 4 Young Mills in flat space. So I need this near extremal black variant metric. So what have I got? I've got time, x, z is the radial direction. So r star is the same as z. I've just changed it because this is how people normally write the metric. And there's a horizon at zh. So fz is 1 minus z4 to zh4. And here is f5, just sitting here not doing anything. Okay, so this is your ADS plane black hole. Okay? And then in this description, phi omega satisfies ingoing boundary conditions of the horizon, which means it behaves like this as z goes to the horizon. So before I apply that to this case, let me just review some things that these authors. This has been a very successful map. And let's just quickly recall two things. And one reason I'm recalling these things and not directly in the flow of this talk is that in this transparency, I'm going to talk about two branch cuts that are not going to be the branch cuts I talk about later. Okay, so there are many branch cuts of thermal field theory. I just want to get these ones out of the way. Okay. So one thing you can do. I'm going to explain where these poles came from in a second. Okay. So the upshot is when you apply this description, you get poles and no branch cuts. Right. So you can take the zero temperature result, and then these poles coalesce to form branch cuts starting from p and minus p, and this is the zero temperature Green function. Okay. The function of omega. This was known, and this is the right answer. So what I'm trying to say is that this description that they wrote down gives you the right answer in a zero temperature limit. And there's a branch cut at zero temperature. And another thing they did is that they applied these correlators, this description, to calculate correlators of conserved charges and study the hydrodynamics and the low frequency, low momentum limit. And the result, again, is something like roughly schematic, like say this is mapping the current correlator. So the result is like this, and the main thing is a pole. Which is in the characteristic place to be the so-called diffusion pole. Okay, and from this expression we read off D, which is the diffusivity coefficient of the dual theory of Schwann coupling. But as was pointed out, this expression doesn't pick up something else that is very characteristic of hydrodynamics, which is advanced class. So hydrodynamics at zero momentum, they're typical power law tails of late time that are not in this expression. And this was resolved by Crofton and Yacker recently, who point out that the tail is a 1 over n effect. So this expression will have a 1 over n correction probably, which also has a branch cut in it. But these are also not the branch cuts I'm going to talk about later. So hydrodynamic branch cuts are 1 over n effects and I'm a larger. Okay? So I just mentioned this to get these branch cuts out of the way. Because people start to confuse me. Alright, so where do these poles come? So I kept drawing these poles and I've argued that it's analytic. And I'm trying to say there's no branch cuts, but there are poles. Okay. So what happens? So we have this Schrödinger equation in the bulk. So we need to solve z goes to zero as the boundary of ADS. So we want to solve. So we need to solve to find phi omega in the bulk, then apply the prescription, and get the correlator from the boundary. Okay. So the general solution has the two general solutions, the second order equation, right? There's a normalizable. And a non-normalizable mode, which just happens to go like this, and these will have some coefficients in front of them, which depend on the frequency of the solution, of course. Okay? So if you plug this into the description that I wrote on the other page, you roughly, after you renormalize, you get this answer, b omega over a omega. So this is where we can see how the analytic structure of the frequency of the Green function is related to the analytic structure of the solutions of the equations. So basically two things can happen. You can get poles when A vanishes, okay? So A omega vanishes. And what does that mean? So that's precisely when you have a normalizable mode. When the non-normalizable part vanishes, you have a normalizable mode, and that, at least as far as infinity is concerned, and that gives you a pole in the propagator. And these are actually quite normal frequencies, okay? So they satisfy ingoing boundary conditions and normalize the boundary conditions in infinity. They're not, because they're complex everywhere, they're not actually normalizable at the horizon. So that's where the poles. The pole, that's the poles are related to the quasi-normal frequencies in the bulb, because that's where this vanishes in this description. Now if you want to get branch cuts, then either B or A has to have a branch cut in the omega. Okay? And that means the solution to branch cuts is a function of omega. So to get branch cuts in your frequency in your the tardy Green's function, you need to have branch cuts in the solution to the bulb. And that's where proof didn't exist, at least in that bound before. Okay? Good. So, to summarize, the picture is, in the strict, in Langevin's infinity limit, this correlator has poles and no branch cuts. And this is the structure of the poles. Now, you're going to tell me, I haven't actually really proved this, because what I've really only shown is that there are no poles here, and no branch cuts in this region. There could be branch cuts further down. I think it's unlikely, actually, the main thing I want to make is that there are poles. Okay, I don't actually care if there are a few more branch cuts floating down, floating around a large body of omega. And as P gets large, what happens is that all these poles move up and towards the axis. So by taking large P, I can get arbitrarily large number of poles inside the strip where I know there are no branch cuts. Okay, so I think. Well, it would be nice to show, but I think there are no branch cuts. And there's certainly a region in which there are poles and branch cuts. All right. So just quickly, just because we spent some time doing this, it's not actually useful, I think. But you can use this prescription. I don't think you can use this prescription to plot the Green's function and the function of omega. I'm just trying to show that it's a very concrete prescription. You solve the equation in the bulk, and you get functions on the boundaries and functions of omega. So here I've plotted the Green's function along the real axis at various p, at various values of momentum. And what you see, the most notable feature is this sort of resonance, and that's just the lowest quasi normal pole near the axis. And in fact, that pole is near omega equals p in the real terms. And so that's why as you increase p, this pole, this is roughly omega equals p, it's like. And then it's minus p. Okay, so I'm just trying to show you that it's all there, complete. All right, so now let me say something about alpha fine fractions. So basically, the logic's going to be, at the end of the day, that poles are strong coupling and branch cuts are weak coupling, and that's an issue. Right? But to be sure about this, what we want to say is that these poles don't go away at first order in perturbation from either of these two limits. Okay. It's not just an artifact of taking the infinite coupling limit. Right, so let's deal with the alpha fine corrections first. Now, alpha fine corrections are difficult because the full alpha fine corrected action is not known. Some of the alpha fine corrected action is known, but not all of it. So what this idle number of alpha beauty depends on is that only that the alpha fine expansion should be consistent. That is, that the alpha fine corrections are never bigger than the background. Okay? And if they were bigger, then we wouldn't be able to trust the original background. All sorts of things could be problematic. So, I perturb the solution. So, phi 0 is a solution I had before. Epsilon is something that measures the alpha fine corrections. And I have phi prime, which is perturbation. Now, what you do is you plug that into the Schrödinger equation. Okay, this is the first order. Yeah. I think a similar argument could be used at higher orders also. So you plug in, you perturb the Schrödinger equation, and what you're left with before you see, you find that this perturbation in epsilon, phi prime, satisfies the same equation as the zero order mode does, except there's an extra inhomogeneous piece, which is the background solution acted on by some higher order operator that comes from the higher order action with the alpha fine corrections. Good. Now, where the consistency comes in is that epsilon is small, and so I want these two terms. So if I put the epsilon on the other side, these two terms are the correction, and V of phi naught is the zeroth order term. And all I'm saying here is I want the corrections to be smaller than the zeroth order term. Okay. Now if I assume that, I can actually use the same arguments before. So I turn this into an integral equation, I write down the Born series, and write it as an exponential, and then I can bound. I base it from one of the arguments, and I use these arguments, this inequality, to bound the correction in terms of this is final order, in terms of the original five. So there's basically almost exactly the same argument as before. There's one extra step in where I have to get rid of this operator O, an expression in terms of first order quantities, and I get a 1 over epsilon independent. 1 over epsilon is obviously very big. I don't care about that. So, okay. And also, the consistency condition implies that GRM takes the same form of some function of frequency or another function of frequency. And I think it shouldn't be surprising. Okay? So we have some differential equation with some solution that has a certain analytic structure in terms of frequency omega. I perturb the solution of the equation consistently by some small perturbation that you wouldn't expect the solutions to change the analytic, have funny analytic behavior as a function of a regular perturbation of the differential equation. But you can prove it.
Yeah. So the poles that you have are just simple poles, right?
Yes.
So I guess what you would expect is that maybe with the alpha prime corrections, they can come close to each other, and you will have double poles that will grow into branch paths. I mean, that's the only thing that you can worry about.
Right. So I will talk a bit about what can happen shortly.
So you may want to look for the points where two poles can.
Right. So the poles separated by all the T's by very sort of a large amount compared to alpha prime.
So then you're safe.
So what, you're right, but what I can argue at the moment is that there's some band in the strong coupling, about the strong coupling points, where you have poles. And then I'm going to try to argue there's some band here, where you have branch cuts. Now, obviously, in the middle, there are various ways in which they can merge, but this is a non-analytic process, as a function of lambda. I mean, if you want to write down some function that interpolates between branch types and poles, function of lambda, the lambda dependence will be non-analytic, and so there'll be a phase transition. So I'm not saying it can't. I mean, it can happen, obviously, but it's interesting if it happens.
What I wanted to say is that most probably you're safe. I mean, this argument that you have is true.
Well, they won't. They're happy. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it should be fine. Now, do you have it? Right, I mean, I think the only thing, right, is that simple poles that can't be said. Yes. Now, you could worry about non-perturbative alpha prime corrections. There's no obvious non-perturbative. I mean, so that means you're looking for Walsh instantons in the bomb. And there are two cycles in the bomb. I haven't addressed it systematically, but I think. Then there are obvious worlds, for instance, in the box that you can shoot these. Good. Okay, so now I'm going to go to weak coupling. And again, let me I want to start by reviewing known, very well established physics. And the key thing is that the plasma that I found out recently, actually, and plasma is really very interesting, rich physical systems. And there are various times, one way of thinking about the physics, there are various timescales associated with them. And there's a really beautiful review by Arnold and Yaffe in 1997 where he reviews these various phenomena that can happen in plasma. Alright, so well, there's the obvious timescale, okay, which is 1 over the temperature. And that gives you, that's a thermal wavelength, it gives you typical energy, T is the typical energy of the particles. And in this regime, when you're up to the timescales of this order, you can use perturbation theory absolutely fine, in fact, because the coupling is weak, free theory is quite a good approximation. Then the next timescale you come to is the Debye length or plasma frequency. And so the physical effect of this is that it screens electric charge. Right? So I put an electron in the blue molecule charge, electron, and then it just gets an exponential decay. Right? It doesn't. It's green, so there's a mass, but the gluon has a mass. And in this case, one speaks about quasi particles or dress gluons. And this is really just it's sort of a one loop effect. Okay? It's just a thermal mass, gluon getting thermal mass. And there's some subtlety when the external momentum is of the same order as this, then you have to do some perturbation theory, which are called half thermal loops. Okay, but it's basically just this diagram giving this mass to the gluons, which gives it a screen. Now, a curious one thing that happens is the static magnetic charge does not get screened. And that's not, I know that's totally obvious, but it doesn't. Okay, so the static, I put a static monopole, magnetic monopole, it won't get screened in this, within this time scale. So that's why there's another time scale, which is the magnetic screening scale. And this is actually much more non-trivial than the electric screening scale, because it's non-material. And how do we know about it then? Well, it's a bit like M-theory. I mean, the dimensional reduction is useful. So if we consider the static theory on X1 plus R3, just do the time integral, okay? The time is 1 over t. So you get this in three dimensions, one in the lambda t in front of it. Let's call this a 3D coupling, which is dimensional. And this 3D theory is known to be confining, okay? And this is the confining scale of the lambda t. So, and when you reduce, you're sort of integrating out the electric direction, so all you have left is the magnetic components, and that's defined. So actually, if you calculate the Wilson loop in this theory, even if they were in the strictly in four dimensions, the deconfined phase, the static magnetic charges screen confined. No, so at this scale, okay, this is a non-conservative scale. You can't see that in perturbation theory. And in fact, what happens in perturbation theory in four dimensions is you get infrared divergences. You get various loops. And infrared divergences, and what people do is cut them off with this magnetic scale by hand. Right. I think this is controlled. I think it's been saying this for years, but there is the need to consider this non-perturbative scale. And one more scale I want to consider is so-called Chasmon. So the many. This is not the exhaustive distance scale. This is so-called Chasmon damping rate. And that basically, because everything I've been considering so far has been non-collisional. I've considered the propagator and getting a mass, but I haven't considered actual interactions between the constituents of the gas. This scale, I'm going to say, is the width, so it's a typical collision rate in this puzzle. All right, and so it's schematically, so this is the dominant diagram. For collision, it turns out to be an exchange of a gluon. And so let's quickly estimate the differential cross section of this. I'm going to take the density times the differential cross section. The density is just t cubed. Okay, it's normal thermodynamics. What about this graph? Well, there are 2 points there. I'm sorry. This is the square of the amplitude, okay, because it's the cross section. So there's a g there, and the lambda is g squared. It's an n, so you have. So I get a g to the fourth power. Yes, g squared, g to the fourth, which is lambda squared. And then this propagator here just has a 1 over q squared in it. And I'm squaring it to get, I'm squaring the amplitude to get the cross section, so that gives me this 1 over q to the fourth. Now, if I want to get a total cross section, I have to integrate this. Because I'm considering collisions at all possible momenta, I mean, q is external momentum. And we see that there's a divergence, okay, a small q. And so those are merely collinear processes, okay, merely collinear scattering, there's an infrared divergence. But this one's actually fine. This is not a real divergence because we're considering space-like momenta. And remember, there was this Debye mass. So that's going to cut off that space-like integral. And so this seems to be cut off by 1 over the Debye mass. So you get lambda t. Okay. And then this is just the total cross-section. Now, in fact, this isn't quite the right answer. There's actually higher loops. There is an extra divergence that you need to use a magnetic scale to cut off, and that enhances this process by an extra log lambda. Okay. So this is basic idea. All right, so we've got these scales. So let me start with the free theory. So this is to work at the temperatures up to about 1 over t. That's where it climbs. Up to around 1 over t. Okay, and so in free theory, I want to calculate, so now we're looking at the propagator, it's the same propagator we had before. In free theory, and this is the graph. Some external momentum, so there's a momentum p prime going around the loop. So, yeah, okay. Right, so maybe I'll go through this kind of quickly. So, we need to use the thermal propagator. So the gluon is what's going on this loop. Has this thermal, this is the thermal propagator. And N is the boson time distribution. So this is kind of, okay, and what am I working in? I'm working in time and Fourier transforms to spatial bits, so it's frequency. What am I saying? It's momentum and time. Okay. E and T. And P is just mod P. And so this is sort of normal kind of propagator, but with some practical boson distribution. Okay, this is the standard form of the thermal gluon propagator. Okay, so now we need to calculate this loop. And so I've written down the formula to show that it exists, but you plug this in, you use your Feynman rules, and you've got some integral over this internal momentum and some factors of the Bose-Einstein distribution and so on. So it turns out you can do this integral. Any questions?
I was wondering, do you have just free convention?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Just with just purely, I mean, yeah, exactly. Let's go. Okay, so you do the integral, and I've written down the result just to show that it's there. One thing I should say, that what we actually want is a retarding propagator, not just a two-point function. And so we take this commutator and just complete the T in front. And this is the result. So there's some formula here. The main thing about this is that as T goes to infinity, this decays with an oscillatory power law when P is not zero. Which is now sort of the first contrast we have with bulk, where it decayed exponentially. The perturbators decayed exponentially with time. And very roughly, I think, this is because we're still in the free theory, and we've got some momentum. It can't dissipate into other modes, it's conserved, so it falls off kind of slowly. Whilst in the interacting theory, thermal theory, strong lambda, the momentum can be quickly shifted into other modes, and then this particular mode that we're looking at can decay. So we've got a power law decay. So bells from my previous discussion, this should mean that we have a branch cut. But also, perhaps, I don't know, surprisingly, you can calculate the Fourier transform of this thing. And you get this. So there's some stuff here, but the main thing I want to focus on is this. So there's a log, and there's some gamma. Anyway, so there's branch cuts. This is, if I plot the sort of analytic structure of this Green function, this is what I get. Okay. So it's sort of purely branch cuts and no faults. Right, so now we need to consider what happens at later times and what happens when we include quantum corrections. But just before I do that, let me quickly make some notes about this expression. So first, just a kind of brief, interesting note that translating to gravity, what this is saying is that if you're considering black holes in this very strong curvature regime, somehow they're not as black as the classical black holes, in the sense that what is this fall-off? This fall-off is the rate at which stuff is falling into the black hole. I mean, that's the bulk interpretation of the exponential decay, is that things are falling into the black hole. So it seems to be strongly curved black holes, things fall off slower. And this is quite a very similar observation to made recently in this plasma ball paper. Where they can also look at the absorbability kind of our plasma balls, and in the small lambda regime, things can go straight through them, which they can't do at large lambda. Okay, so I think there's a consistent picture here that these, I mean, there's not really any space time. I mean, but if you want to think of these as black holes and small lambda in it, then they're not as black as the classical black holes. And then kind of a throwaway comment, the second one, I don't know what to make of it, but somebody else will know me about. So these things are vertical, these branch cuts are going straight down. And then normally the quasi-normal modes go out, except for BTZ and other topological black holes, the quasi-normal poles go straight down. So I just mentioned this in case somebody that maybe in some sense, these small lambda black holes are topological in some sense. Consistency check with our expressions is that if you take t goes to zero, you get the same result, mu squared minus p squared, squared log, mu squared minus p squared, the same result we got at large lambda, and that's because trace squared is BPS operator, so at zero temperature, it should agree. And also another sort of side remark that, that we also computed these green functions on the S3 plus R case, okay? And the results together in terms of theta functions. Maybe better than someday. All right, so now last 5 minutes. Good. Now I need to talk about quantum corrections. Now, this is difficult because these calculations are not easy. And so what I'm going to discuss here is basically qualitative, what is qualitatively expected, very generic work on plasmas, on propagators and plasmas. Okay. It shouldn't be too controversial, I think. Right. I mean, mostly there'll be many people calculating many two-point functions in applied temperature theory. Normally, not this tracer square. Most people are interested in energy momentum two-point functions. But this is quite a generic story. So what happens? So the first thing at this scale, the things going around the loop get a mass. Okay, this thermal mass I mentioned. And these branch cuts I drew are just special branch cuts at peak, right? It's just for the pair production of gluons. And giving them a mass will only just shift. So what it will do is shift those. So these cuts. And this P is going to shift a little bit to this value there. Okay? So it's now a massive thing that's getting produced going around the loop. And then the other one, then we've also got to take into account the width, which is the collision rate. And so that is going to introduce an exponential decay. Okay? I mean, everything at the end of the day does decay exponentially. It just decays on a much slower scale in perturbation theory than it does at a strong couple. The late times compared to this guy, that distance here kicks in and they give you the exponential hit in late times. And also you get more branch cuts because once you've got these things going, so this has momentum peak, but this thing going around the loop has got arbitrary momentum p prime, so it produces things here with arbitrary momentum. And so you actually get more cuts going from momentum equals zero. Okay, this is being seen in many studies. It seems to be very unlikely. Well, in fact, the turbulent corrections can change these branch cuts into poles. I mean, I think this is very good. Yeah. one would like to do would be to establish a weak coupling, whether there are or not non-determinate effects that break the branch down into poles. Okay, that is an interesting question. Or not, but it's difficult because it's not determinative. And another question you might want to say, well, are there obvious alternative phase structures? And then we could then test. And so let's suppose it's a phase transition, what is it? So here's one example, a very simple sort of deformation of the minimal phase diagram that I did before. It's this Gross-Witten transition. Instead of joining there, which I've given the point, it goes off to infinity. Okay. And what would be the signature of this? Well, this phase diagram is basically made by looking at the polygon loop. Okay, so you've got this polygon loop, it's a matrix in field theory, a unitary matrix, so it has a distribution of eigenvalues in a circle. And, what's down here is called the confined phase, and it's uniform, the uniform distribution. Now, what the Gross-Witten transition, and when you go above that, it becomes non-uniform. Now, what this line is, which is a Gross-Witten phase transition, what that does is means there's a gap. So the question is whether there's a gap or box in the distribution. And so in a normal in the picture during my third transparency, there would be an ungapped non-uniform distribution here, and then a gapped one here. So to tell whether this line is in the middle, what we need to do is determine the distribution up here. So if we can calculate the distribution of the polygon loop at strong coupling in the deconfined phase, we have to say, is there a gap or is there not a gap? And if there is not a gap, then there's a Gross-Witten transition as a function of coupling. Unfortunately, this is not so easy to calculate either. But I think it's in principle a totally well-defined question, and you want to be able to calculate this polygon loop's eigenvalue distribution at strong coupling, and then you could see whether this particular possibility is realized. And then the final question, which is, I think, relates both to weak and strong coupling. So the normal picture you have is that this phase down here is the confined phase, up there in the deconfined phase. And normally, in deconfined phases, you have continuum of degrees of freedom. Okay, I mean, and they have branch cuts. I mean, that's the branch cuts. And the reason you get poles at large n in confined phases is that the singular interactions are suppressed by 1 over n. So the poles are very characteristic of confined phases. And it seems to be very curious that up here, you get poles. Okay? I mean, normally they're on the real axis, they're poles off the real axis. Okay? So they're not your normal confined pole, but they're still poles. Okay? Something's happened to the continuous, they're not a continuous set of degrees of freedom. And whatever the theory is a weak coupling, if they're poles of weak coupling, that's also very strange. Because you've got some weakly coupled theory, but nonetheless, the interactions are somehow suppressed by, say, 1 over n. And so I think this phase up here, I mean, I don't know how deep confined it is. Okay. Right, and one way to think about these ideas would be if you could control the independent one in any direction, because if they are confining poles, then you expect them to thicken at one over n, which maybe by the argument you said, I don't know, maybe it can't happen, but that's what you might want to look for.
If you consider the integral, the closed integral around one of those poles in the omega plane, I mean, for the simple pole, that would be the residue. But if the pole happens to grow into branch cut, that would be the period around that cycle. And that shouldn't change, because, I mean, basically, it's a kind of a topological environment.
Right, so I have thought a little bit about these arguments. So
and then you could try to continue that and see if you can see that on the other end of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to do this precisely because these things could move about, so I can't just fix. I mean, I don't know how to track the pole, as it were, from which strong coupling, so I don't know which point.
Yes, you wouldn't know that, but you could compute it for every single pole that you find at a strong coupling, mm-hmm. and then compute it for the branch caps that you find.
Then
try to match the rest of the answers.
Oh, I see. So this is where the. So you're saying the integral around here
yes.
should be the same as the integral around that.
Yes. It should be the, if that pore grows into branch cavity, it would be the integral around the.
A more likely scenario is that these poles somehow will merge into a single frame. Right,
this is assuming the very naive picture that
each pore
grows into.
No, that could also be possible, but there are all these branch cuts going down into that link.
Yeah, it could be the two poles.
So let me just check. So you wouldn't say the inflow around here and here should be the same as inflow around.
Well, no, even if a single pole grows into a branch cut, that integral should not change.
Right.
And whatever it is will be merged.
Yes.